Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A deadly 10-minute barrage ripped through crowded commuter trains on the Madrid rail system this morning. 10 backpacks stuffed with TNT exploded, killing at least 190 people and wounding more than 1,200, many very seriously. Spanish authorities were first quick to blame ETA, the Basque separatist movement, but later in the day found Arab language tapes and detonators and said they are now considering all possibilities. One Al-Qaeda-linked claim has been made, no matter who is responsible. If the struggle to end terrorist violence against innocent people is a worldwide effort, today was a bloody setback. Tonight on Point, a devastating terrorist attack in Spain and what it says about the global war on terror. We begin in Madrid. Lisa Abend has been following the story for the Christian Science Monitor. Lisa, first the damage. Where are the numbers of dead and wounded headed at this hour?
The last I heard, most of the newspapers here were citing 200 dead and 1,430 injured.
So they continue to climb, and we understand many of those injured are very grievous injuries.
Yes. The news was reporting about an hour ago that among the injured, nearly 50 were in very critical condition.
How is Spain taking this? How is this rippling through Spanish society tonight?
Well, the mood here is very somber, more than anything. There have been a number of manifestations, both organized ones and spontaneous ones. And in both cases, more than anger, it seems that people want to demonstrate their solidarity with the victims, and I think their general weariness with terrorism here in Spain.
Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar said today, March 11th now has its place in the history of infamy. Are 9/11 parallels being drawn or not?
Yes, they're actually all over the place. We just saw the front page of the newspapers that are coming out tomorrow. In Spain, they refer to 9/11 as 11S for September. Mm-hmm. And here on all of the front pages, it now says 11M.
Lisa, how are Spaniards responding to this question of who did this? It seems pretty clear at this hour that no one really knows. And yet in that confusion, what are you hearing? What's in the media? What's the gist of Spanish response in terms of who to blame?
Well, as you can imagine, it's changed a lot over the course of the day. I think at the beginning, everyone assumed that it was ETA. Early in the day, the Minister of the Interior went on the air and, in response to reporters' questions asking if there might be some doubt over this, he was very firm. There was absolutely no doubt that this was ETA. Mm-hmm. He has since backed off and has, as you said, has now come out and affirmed that they're following a number of different paths. As far as people on the street, the sense among many Spaniards that I've both talked to and seen on television seems to be that they still believe that it is ETA. The government itself is still saying that ETA is their primary suspect. But it has gotten significantly more confused in the last 5 or 6 hours.
This Arabic language tapes of the Quran were found. There's also this claim from an Arabic newspaper came through London,
right.
An Al-Qaeda-linked organization saying, I'm quoting here from a letter that was faxed there, calling this Operation Death Trains, saying, we have succeeded in infiltrating the heart of Crusader Europe and struck one of the bases of the Crusader Alliance. This is issued by, what's the name of this group? The Abu Hafs al-Masri Brigades. Has there been any hint in advance of today's huge attack that there was a threat from any al-Qaeda-linked organization?
Not that I have heard. There, Spain has been active in prosecuting people here who were somehow linked with the attacks of 9/11, but I have not, until this point, heard any threats against Spain in particular.
The scale of this morning's attack was just shocking, overwhelming, Lisa. When 9/11 happened in the United States, the television cameras were quite careful about exactly what they showed. Europeans saw, in many cases, more than Americans did of the real gruesome scenes. We're reading today from these train yards and train stations of flesh and ribs all over the road, ribs and brains and body parts. Are Spaniards seeing that?
Yes. It's television, and all of the media here are much more graphic. Even just a little while ago, they were on the nightly news announcing the unidentified victims who were still in hospitals and identifying them by their wounds, by their clothing, by their hairstyles in ways that you would just never hear in the United States. They were clearly hoping that people would recognize their family members and come into the hospital.
So they have the same problem that New Yorkers had on 9/11 of
right.
missing relatives, not knowing where they might be, even if they're alive.
Right.
Lisa, you spoke of a weariness in Spain about what?
Well, I mean, ETA has been quite active and over 35 years now. And I think that the sentiment against ETA, especially in the last couple of years, has grown increasingly strong, even within the Basque Country itself, although that autonomy movement is quite strong. Many members of nationalist parties themselves have distanced themselves from ETA in ways that you didn't see before. And there's just a widespread sense that enough is enough. In fact, that has become the sort of slogan of the reaction against these attacks in Spanish, basta ya, which is basically enough.
The scale of today's attacks are way beyond anything we've seen before. But ETA has had a drumbeat of attacks. Last year, 3 people killed. In 2023, in 2001, 15, the biggest attack ever, in 1987, 21 in a supermarket in Barcelona. So they have a capacity to deliver terrorist attacks, and they have repeatedly done so.
Yes, they have, although one of the reasons that this attack raises questions about its authorship is that in the past they have not, as you said, the attack in that supermarket in Barcelona was the biggest one, and in that one, 21 people died. They have never mounted an attack of this scale before.
Meanwhile, Spain has 1,300 troops in Iraq working with the coalition there, and the country unimaginably is going to the polls in a couple of days for general elections. What a context.
Well, yes, it has. I mean, one of the interesting things here, and I think this is partly why ETA sort of came to the fore as the immediate suspect, is that the question of what to do about ETA has been prominent throughout these elections. Just last, I guess on February 29th, the police here intercepted a van that was being driven by 2 members of ETA, and that was loaded with about 1,000 pounds of explosives, apparently directed toward Madrid and directed toward an attack here. And that immediately was sort of fed into the dominant rhetoric of the campaign, which is which of the two parties will best stamp out terrorism here?
Well, everybody has a huge challenge now and a tragedy in Spain today. Lisa Abend, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Lisa Abend is covering the Madrid bombing for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Madrid. We're talking tonight about the deadly terrorist attack in Spain and what it says about the global war on terror. What do you see in the wreckage of the Spanish trains today? Are the blasts Spain's problem, Europe's problem, everyone's problem? Is the war on terror working? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Ian Lesser, Vice President and Director of Studies at the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's a former member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff. Good evening and welcome, Ian Lesser.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Also with me tonight from Arlington, Virginia, is Anthony Cordesman. He holds the chair in strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and has served in both the State Department and as Director of Intelligence Assessment in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Good evening, and thanks for being with us again, Anthony Cordesman.
Good evening.
Anthony Cordesman, if I may turn to you first, just your top-of-mind thoughts on witnessing this enormous attack today in Madrid.
Well, it obviously is a horrifying event and one that struck at a very important ally to the United States and one that's very active militarily in Iraq. And that, of course, creates the problem that the linkages in terrorism are not simply directed at the United States, but could be directed at Europe. The problem, of course, here is a tape with Arabic on it doesn't necessarily mean that anyone from the Arab world was involved. The explosive that they seem to have used was, I gather, identical to the explosive that was found earlier, some 500 pounds of it, in a van which was very clearly tied to ETA. So you really have the question here, and it's a very serious question. Who is to blame? Is it possible you have ties between Western and Islamic extremist groups? Is the timing designed to suit Spanish political purposes or international political purposes? And I think this is really a warning that the war on terrorism, the broader war, is anything but over and very difficult to characterize.
And Ian Lesser, what do you read in the carnage in Madrid? What do you see there? Where do you see the trail of blame? Do you see potential cooperation between ETA and international terrorists, as Anthony Cordesman describes them? What do you read here?
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with very much of what Anthony Cordesman has said. I would say that he's right. It's too early to tell, in a sense, and we have to see what the evidence shows in terms of who was really involved with this. But it strikes me that whether it is ETA or whether it is an al-Qaeda-linked group, Muslim extremists, the implications in either case are highly significant. If it is ETA, it marks a very, very striking departure from the kind of violence they've been perpetrating over the last decades, which, as your correspondent said earlier, have tended to be of a much more modest, horrifying but more modest kind. Assassinations, small-scale bombings, larger-scale bombings where there was some notice given in advance, never really with the intent of causing mass lethality. And if it's true that ETA really has done this, then that marks a change that Spain will have to reckon with. It's very serious. If it's not ETA and it's an Islamist group, that similarly is very striking because it marks a very marked escalation in a kind of global campaign of terror against Western targets for some of the reasons that you've already mentioned. Mm. Spain has been very active in Iraq, has been very strongly supportive of U.S. policy, but it seems that there may also be reasons that are more specifically related to Spain's own sort of historical and current policies in the world. And that's something that all European countries will have to deal with.
Anthony Cordesman, what do you make of the scale and sophistication or at least coordination of this attack today? Are we seeing a global escalation in scale when it comes to terror?
Well, it's very possible. I think one of the striking changes that occurred with the sort of Salafi terrorism we've seen come from al-Qaeda is that you kill for killing's sake. You are basically trying to make a statement so bloody that you can drive the United States out of a country or that you basically can alienate the West from an Islamic country. Now, we don't know whether that was done in this case, but you did have four trains attacked. Each of them used the same basic mechanism. They were separated by a matter of minutes. Two of them were trains closing in on the same station, and there were actually five attacks because they found two more bombs that did not explode. So the killing could have been considerably higher.
It's an odd moment to feel grateful, but we will feel grateful for that. Anthony Cordesman, Ian Lesser, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We are talking tonight about today's devastating terrorist attack in Spain and what it says about the global war on terror. You can join the conversation. What do you see in the wreckage of the Spanish trains? Why is terrorism scaling up? And is the U.S. war on terror working? Is it relevant to what's going on here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's devastating terrorist attack in Madrid and what it says about the global war on terror. We're joined from Los Angeles tonight by Ian Lesser of the Pacific Council on International Policy, from Arlington, Virginia, by Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can join this conversation as well. How effective has the global response to terrorism been since 9/11/01? Have we had the right priorities in this struggle, the right strategy, the right instincts? Must terrorism now simply be a fact of life like the weather? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anthony Cordesman, that question to you. What does today's attack say, if anything, given all the confusion that remains at this moment, about how appropriately designed and executed Washington's quote-unquote war on terror has been, is being?
Well, remember, we're not the only country fighting a war on terror, and the Spanish were fighting against the ETA long before we suffered from the attacks at 9/11. The problems, too, in Spain are very complicated. There's a large Islamic population coming in from North Africa. Many of the attempted attacks on the United States were made by people coming from North Africa before the men with Saudi passports succeeded in 9/11. So the patterns we're looking at are not something where the United States can win the war on terrorism in any global sense. That is an international struggle, and a lot of it is being fought within Islamic countries, countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Morocco, in fact, virtually every country that has a secular regime.
But President Bush put it right from the get-go as a global war on terror. He was very specific. Yes, he wanted allies in that, but he didn't aim this only at al-Qaeda. He essentially said, we will go after all terrorists everywhere.
Well, rhetoric is all very well, but there are some 200 countries in the world. Al-Qaeda alone has affiliates with some 60 to 80 different organizations. And I believe the President and the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, also warned that this wasn't going to be some sudden or quick struggle, that it was going to go on for years after bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were effectively destroyed, if they are destroyed. And I think the reality is that we are talking, given all of the demographic, social, and political problems in the Islamic world and other parts of the world, about something which in one form or another, perhaps in cycles, is going to go on for decades.
Ian Lesser, how do you see today's attack in the context of the war on terror, a global war, as Anthony Cordesman says, but defined and championed by Washington and President Bush? Does this look like a failure in that war? Does the war on terror look irrelevant to what happened in Madrid today? Are they even related?
Well, I think, we have to have the right starting point. And for me, the right starting point is not the notion of a victory, certainly not a victory in the short term against this problem, which Tony rightly notes is something that's going to go on for decades. I think what we need to come to grips with is the question of whether we have the right notion in mind when we talk about terrorist groups with global reach. President Bush has spoken about a war on terrorism with an emphasis on terrorist groups with global reach. I think we have tended to interpret that in terms of groups that can reach us. I think what the bombings in Madrid today show is that we can't be quite so restrictive. There are a lot of groups operating around the world, many of them affiliated with al-Qaeda, who pose a risk to our interests that may not be direct. I think our interests are affected very strongly when an ally of ours is targeted in this way. So I think that's something we're going to have to take into account much more, and I think it's going to help us in terms of the kind of intelligence cooperation and police and judiciary cooperation that is really at the heart of counterterrorism strategy over the longer term.
But as Americans who have something to say about who executes policy and what that policy will be, put yourself just in your shoes as an American voter tonight, looking at what happened today. Does it reflect well or poorly on Washington's strategy since 9/11, in its general strategy and the global environment it's created in addressing this problem?
Well, I'm not so sure whether it will be judged reflecting well or poorly. I think for most Americans, perhaps understandably, the key measure is whether there are further attacks on our own territory. But I think if we step back from that kind of understandable first instinct, the measure really does need to be what is the sort of global volume and scale of terrorist attacks. If we are going to be with this problem for many, many years to come, we're going to have to treat it in diverse ways, and we're going to have to accept that we're in the business of containment, not necessarily victory. And we need also to put a lot of effort into making sure that the kind of what we can looks like a highly lethal attack that we saw today, or even September 11th, isn't transcended by even more lethal attacks using weapons of mass destruction, it's a remote possibility. It's a remote contingency, but it is one that poses really an existential risk for us.
But citizens have to ask themselves, I guess, wherever the terror lands, because it clearly can travel. Who and what policy should we be supporting here? Maybe unscrew it from Madrid a little bit. But what is your sense of the gist of this effort? If it's going to go on for decades, to have the right strategy would seem to be very important.
Yeah, I think, you know, this will obviously make everyone feel less secure, and especially in Europe. I would hope that one of the effects of this is to produce a more concerted policy across the Atlantic, because Iraq, let's face it, has had a negative effect on cohesion across the Atlantic on a number of different security issues. And it would be terrible if it began to affect cooperation on counterterrorism. I think the effect of this kind of attack probably is the opposite. It's probably to unite politicians and policymakers and publics on both sides of the Atlantic. And we really ought to be in the business of doing everything that we can to help Spain deal with the consequences of this and to make sure that there aren't other events of this kind in Europe. Look, we're coming up to an Olympics in Athens. In the summer,
August.
And the kind of thing we saw in Madrid today sadly could also take place in other parts of Southern Europe and Europe.
We're going to be talking about that on this show the first of next week. Anthony Cordesman, let me put to you the letter that came in today from the Brigade of Abu Hafs al-Masri. It came to the Arabic newspaper Al-Quds al-Arabi in London, talking about the brigade's death squad having penetrated one of the pillars of the Crusade Alliance, Spain, and it said, "This is part of settling old accounts with Spain, the Crusader, and America's ally in its war against Islam." How much credibility do you give to one note or letter like this? Any at all? Some? Anthony Cordesman?
We do have to give it some credibility, but we need to remember that when the Lockerbie incident took place, for the first 9 months, all of the intelligence indicators indicated that the attacker was Syria. And over time, it became clear it was not Syria at all. It was Libya. And you had a newspaper and media report after report for more than 6 months about the Syrian threat. And it was based on indicators which were perhaps stronger than a single letter.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem here that we're dealing with is that almost any movement can issue a letter in Arabic. A lot of these groups have no track record.
Right.
Often we hear about new organizations exactly once or twice, and then the name is never heard of again, and this is inside the Islamic world. Now, anyone in Europe who is trying to create the image or the uncertainty as to who is to blame might very well, if they were in ETA, use exactly this approach, because on the one hand, they'd have the political effect that they desired, and on the other hand, they'd create a great ambiguity.
On the other hand, last October, these audio tapes came out reportedly from Osama bin Laden saying that al-Qaeda had the, quote, right to respond at any suitable time and place against countries with forces in Iraq, and he listed Spain. Is it possible that al-Qaeda would piggyback on an ETA operation trying to assert its activity?
Well, certainly it's possible, and that's, again, part of the problem we're dealing with, because we have tapes, we have letters, we have a similar ambiguity inside Iraq right now, where one letter from what it almost a begging letter from an affiliate of Al-Qaeda is being seen as sort of characterizing a good part of the threat we face inside Iraq, but we don't know whether that letter is representative of the movements involved.
Anthony Cordesman, Ian Lesser, I want to turn to my callers this evening, if I may. Gary is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Tom. I've spent a considerable amount of time in Spain as a journalist and in the Basque Country, and I just wanted to say that I think, although I don't have any more evidence than any of the callers and the speakers tonight on the authorship of this attack, that it really does go against the grain of ETA, because even within Spain, ETA does care about certain support.
They care, but they killed 23 people in 2015, 2001. These are not small numbers.
If you'll indulge me with this perverse logic, which is not my logic, but I think credibly I can say it's ETA's logic. I spent a whole day with one of ETA's founders once, and I've spent a lot of time with ETA's rank-and-file supporters in Spain. And I think those are the people that ETA still wants to have on its side. And the thinking of this core group, who maybe is 10, 20,000 people or maybe not more, but they vote regularly for a very radical party aligned with ETA, is that the military and the police are legitimate targets in Spain, and the kind of indiscriminate bombing like this is not. And in fact,
that sounds nice, but that doesn't jibe with the record here. 21 people killed in a supermarket in Barcelona. That's not a police hangout.
This is true, but that stands out precisely because it was an exception, and that ETA had to apologize for it afterwards, which is unheard of in ETA's history, where it is proud and its political supporters are proud of every assassination and bombing. But that particular one stood out, and we're talking 15 years ago.
Yeah, Gary, let me ask you, with the time you spent...
I'm not saying I know, but...
I understand. With the time you've spent with ETA, can you imagine an ETA-Al-Qaeda alliance? Is that nonsensical or not?
Well, it's anybody's guess at this point.
It's been suggested today that maybe this was some kind of joint deal, and that accounts for the scale and the coordination and the rest.
What I can tell you is that ETA has had relations in the 80s with the IRA when the IRA was still active, Irish Republican Army. It has had contacts with certain terrorist organizations in Europe. There were once some ties of ETA with some folks in Algeria, but I haven't heard anything in recent years suggesting that ETA was tied to Islamist movements. We can't rule it out.
Yeah, but if it were there, it might be something new. Gary, thanks very much for your call. Anthony Cordesman, I hear you there.
Yeah, I think one thing we need to remember is why the Spanish leaped to assume it was ETA before the tape was discovered, and that was ETA has been under extreme pressure from Spanish counterterrorism. A lot of the movement has been disrupted. It has reason to try to lash out different sort of pressures than it had in the past. And before this incident took place, it was quite clear that ETA had been putting together large amounts of explosive and had been considering much larger attacks than before. And at least the initial reports on the explosive used in these terrorist incidents is that it was the same explosive that were found in the hands of ETA. Now, again, we're sitting here with very little information and a long history of people leaping to conclusions right after the attack and then finding out they were wrong. And if anything, the very fact we have to speculate like this should be a warning that we're very vulnerable throughout the world to people who can assume the identity of another political organization or simply create a false identity and use that as a cover for attacks.
Yeah.
This is not something that we can easily put an end to.
That kind of morphing, camouflaging possibility is chilling in itself. Anna is calling from Boston. Hi, Anna, you're on the air.
Hi there. I just have 2 points. The first one is that I really don't think that the frequency of terrorism across the world is any more than it was in the 1990s or the 1980s. I think the world is very volatile, and despite the bad things that have happened this morning, that we are talking about it because we're sensitive to it because of September 11th, and so we are catching on to the 120 people killed here or the 120 people killed in that country.
Anna, you can see that you see the news. It's never been this large a scale of killing in Spain before, ever. Not in the 80s, you know, not in the 90s. I mean, that's a fact.
Probably not in Spain, but I think that if you think back to the 1990s, mm-hmm. Francis was dealing with the Algerian terrorists then, different types of, you know, IRA was involved in Ireland, and, you know, across the world and other parts of the world, there's been terrorist groups, you know, just doing what they have to do to try to get what they want to get.
And so your second point, Anna?
I'm sorry?
Your second point?
And the second point is that, you know, I think that the I completely forgot my second point, so I'll just leave it as that.
Okay, it's a good one. Oh, you got it?
I'm right on that one, Tom. I mean, I think the caller actually makes a very – actually, both callers have made excellent points.
Yeah.
I fully agree with the points that were made by the previous caller the history of ETA violence in Spain and why this looks very, very different. It's not that we know that it's not ETA. It's just that if it is ETA, it signals something very, very new in their strategy. On the point the current caller is making, I think there is something there. The truth is that we haven't seen a vast increase in the frequency of terrorism. If anything, for a number of years, the frequency of international terrorism was going down. What has gone up is the lethality. And that, of course, has enormous implications. And one of the implications is that the groups responsible for the most lethal kinds of terrorism have very different motives than they had in the past. Most people who look at and study terrorism as a problem would say that ETA was a kind of classic case of the old terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
It was a politically based organization that had a narrow set of political aims, and they used violence in a very kind of targeted way, just enough to terrorize, just enough to get attention, but not enough to completely turn off the constituency and to provoke a huge response.
Right.
And so that's why it's very significant if they've now moved to this kind of near-mass lethality attack. It would make a big, big difference to our understanding of what groups like ETA or some of the others that are still around of the old kind are capable of doing.
Anthony Cordesman, this seems to be a critical point. Do we live in a period of cross-pollination of in the ferocity or lethality of terror?
Well, we have for a long time. I mean, you had cooperation at one point between Japanese terrorist groups, German terrorist groups, and Palestinians. You had cooperation between Libya and the IRA. These patterns are cyclical, and I think Ian raised the key issue that it is when movements see killing as an end in itself, rather than terrorist attacks which are focused on achieving some negotiable political end, that you begin to get particularly concerned.
But why would killing be an end in itself? I mean, isn't there an end behind this somewhere?
Well, I think in the past, for example, you generally used a hijacking or killing to try to achieve a specific political goal.
Mm-hmm.
You made demands. You didn't talk or try to provoke, as bin Laden did, essentially a conflict between cultures and religions. And this is why it is becoming difficult to understand some of the motives here. One problem is you may simply see a change. Terrorists are going to punish their opponents by killing as many civilians as possible. They're going to try to lever much broader changes than they have in the past.
Not narrow, but very wide. Anthony Cordesman, we're heading into a break here, and I know we have to let you go. I'm so grateful to you for joining us tonight. Thanks very much for being
Thank
on.
You.
Anthony Cordesman, Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, author of Terrorism, Asymmetric Warfare, and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's devastating terrorist attack in Spain and what it says about the global war on terror. You can join the conversation tonight if terrorism is a malignancy. What's the source? Are we dealing with the source? Is all terrorism local, or is some global chemistry or agenda pushing the violence? Is the message from Madrid pedal to the metal in the war on terror, or time to recalibrate, reconsider? And has the war on terror built common ground for all terrorists somehow, built a new unity, a new lethality? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight, we've been talking with Ian Lesser in Los Angeles. He's with the Pacific Council on International Policy. He's author of Countering the New Terrorism and Sources of Conflict in the 21st Century. We're joined now from Washington by Daniel Byman. He's Associate Assistant Professor at Georgetown School of Foreign Service, former Research Director at the Center for Middle East Public Policy at the RAND Corporation. Good evening and welcome, Dan Byman.
Thank you.
Dan, let me put that one of those questions straight to you. Today, we have terrorism in Madrid. There's a long history of ETA, Basque separatist violence there. There's been a lot of evolution in how we see terrorism lately. Is all terrorism local, or is there some kind of global chemistry ratcheting up terrorism or the murderousness of terrorism? How do you see it?
There are two ways to look at this. First, terrorist groups learn from each other in a direct sense. They'll train each other. They'll arm each other, often just for money or very simple motives like revenge. And then more broadly, there's a question of what's needed to get on the headlines. It used to be that a few deaths or a few kidnappings commanded tremendous media attention. One of the unfortunate effects of September 11th is the bar is much higher. Now, whether this is the attacks in Madrid are a response to that or not, I don't know. But clearly, what we think of as commanding attention involves a lot more bodies and a lot more deaths.
So the bar's been raised. With that, what do you, Dan Byman, make of the war on terror? This is a moment where we sit back and are tempted to pause and say, are we doing this right? We think of it as we've sent out spies, we've ramped up intelligence, we've sent out a lot of guns and soldiers. Does Madrid illuminate the war on terror in any way to you, whether we've got it right, whether we should be steady as she goes or recalibrating?
It illustrates an important point. Madrid has actually scored numerous important successes against ETA in recent years. It's improved cross-border cooperation with France. It's had a number of successful disruptions of attacks. It has really tried to develop a much more moderate Basque political movement. And all of this shows that no matter how successful you are, if this is ETA, it doesn't necessarily mean you can stop a small band of determined killers from wreaking havoc. And that isn't to say what Madrid is doing is wrong, quite the opposite. But you simply have to recognize, and Americans have to recognize, that even if there are remarkable advances in the struggle against al-Qaeda, a small number of people can kill large numbers, and that's just an unfortunate fact of our own life.
And yet I still find myself wondering if we've got the setting right on the compass here. Brandon is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Brandon. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Love your show. My question or comment is, these kinds of destructive acts have seemed to be more and more become part of our lives here in the United States. We see terrorist acts and the terrorist update every day on the news. We have the national color terrorist safety level.
It's in the air. It's everywhere. We're thinking about it. Yep.
Yeah, everywhere in the news every day. A previous caller had recently had spoken that he had spent a day or more with the founder of one of these radical groups in Spain,
mm-hmm.
And he had implied that these people are not outstandingly rational.
Yet he was saying they didn't want to turn public opinion against them. But where are you headed, Brandon?
Well, my question is, why then have our leaders not made efforts to understand why these terrorists are, what these terrorist purposes are, or what their reasons for it? If I'm sure that anyone who would go to these extents, these lengths, to mm-hmm. plan and execute such acts, for instance, September 11th or what happened today,
yep.
would publish some type of manifest prior to committing the acts or soon thereafter. Why then have our leaders not made efforts to understand these terrorist purpose, and why has these reasons not been made public?
Brandon, we've got it. Ian Lesser, let me put that straight to you.
Sure. Well, there's some interesting questions here. The first observation I'd make is that I think location matters in this. I'm here on the West Coast, and I can tell you that, as shocking as, of course, as September 11th was to everyone everywhere, in general, the sense of risk and exposure is much lesser here. It's not the same.
You're not in Lower Manhattan.
It's different in New York. It's different in Washington. It's different on the Eastern Corridor, where there was a direct experience of this and where, every heightened alert generates a response. Here.
And still, it wasn't that many years ago. There was a terrorist called the Canadian Border headed for LAX.
Sure, absolutely. There have definitely been risks here. And in fact, the very fact that something hasn't happened here in a way increases the problem. But the sense of public exposure, the sense of vulnerability is somewhat less. So location matters. The second point I'd make is that on this question of motives and how you deal with motives, and yeah. I think what the caller was trying to suggest was, why don't policymakers try to figure out what really is behind terrorists and try to work on that
and
problem?
And fix it. Whatever.
I mean, this is of course, you know, this is a simple, it's a fundamental question. The problem, of course, is that the answers are extremely long-term, and even if you diagnose them correctly, and people are trying to do that, it's not within the time horizon of any politician or policymaker to fix those things for the most part. And so we understandably focus on shorter-term problems, interdicting people who are planning to do bad things,
yep.
having the intelligence to interfere with networks who don't wish us well, all these kind of shorter-term objectives which are within the realm of the doable for policymakers.
And yet, Dan Byman, I guess what we hear here is people looking for reassurance that the whole spectrum of the issues being considered. What's your sense of the balance in this counter-terror effort between policing and looking at motivation, root causes? Are you confident? Can you reassure us that it's all going on, or is that second half being ignored?
Looking at root causes is something that certainly, as Dr. Lesser suggests, has not been the same priority as the day-to-day. But there's a problem with that, which is at times we know the root causes, and we simply don't want to fix them, in the sense of a lot of what al-Qaeda wants, for example, is to drive the United States out of the Middle East, and that's not something the United States wants. A lot of what ETA wants is it wants a completely independent Basque homeland, which the rest of Spain doesn't want and much of the Basque country doesn't want. So it's not a question always of understanding. Sometimes it's just a question of disagreement.
So does that mean it's got to be a fight to the death?
You can think about terrorism at times with circles, that there are the immediate fighters who may be extremely committed and have the most extreme demands, and those, it may be a fight to the death. But then you have outer circles of supporters, potential sympathizers, and those can be swayed with intelligent policy. They can be swayed with moderate concessions, such as the right to use the Basque language in Basque areas. And those are the people whom we should focus on, because the most extreme killers, of course, you're not going to be able to do much about. But there is a large group in between where some action is possible.
Abu is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Abu. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This has been a very interesting conversation, and a number of my initial questions have been answered. But let me just offer this. You refer to this, just two quick points.
Yeah.
You refer to this as global war on terror.
It's described that way by President Bush.
Yes, but not by the Brazilian President Lula, not by the Argentinian president, not by many in Asia. And so it has only become a global war on terror since 9/11, even though 60,000 people were killed in Kashmir before that, in Algeria.
Okay, so where does that take you, Abu?
Well, let us look at what are the problems here. And this is one reason why I think Europe, France and Germany especially, were not involved in this war, which Dr. Brzezinski on your show said that we lost our credibility going into a war,
yep.
asking for weapons of mass destruction mm-hmm. in Iraq, which have not come forth since. And this is precisely why these countries, now I don't know that this was caused by al-Qaeda in Madrid, but this is precisely why these countries, perhaps with a host of other reasons, were reticent to join the war.
Because they would become targets themselves?
Of course. I mean, especially when there was nothing, when they probably knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. I mean, this was really part of the calculus.
But the war on terror didn't emerge from Iraq. It emerged, from 9/11.
But in this country, it was given as the extension of the war on terrorism.
Yeah.
And that was the rationale, so much so that 70% of people thought that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11.
Yep. Abu, we've got it. Dan Byman, exactly how global is the war on terror? It's posed that way. It's described that way. Is that an accurate representation?
Well, needless to say, hey, for every country has its own priorities. I think if you look at what the United States is doing, it is a war against al-Qaeda and its affiliates for the most part. There is concern about Hamas, there is concern about Hezbollah, but the United States is not going to Sri Lanka to take on the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam. It's not going into Spain, for example, to go against ETA. So every country is focused. What I think President Bush was trying to accomplish was simply trying to increase global cooperation on this issue. The rhetoric of global war is something that, of course, politicians and statesmen use to try to mobilize mass and diplomatic opinion behind them. I don't think we need to read so much into a particular phrase one way or the other.
Well, it's a phrase, but people are also wondering exactly what's going on. Ian Lesser, as you sit here tonight, with everything we've seen in the last two or three years, with what we've seen today, horribly in Madrid, how do you see the gist of this conflict? Is it worsening? Is it steady as she goes? Is it getting better?
Well, you know, again, I go back to this point of, you know, what do we hope to accomplish with this? I think we can certainly hope to contain parts of the terrorism problem that are most most dangerous for us. We can try to make sure that terrorism as a tactic doesn't become a dominant way of behavior in the world, which would hurt our interests terribly and the interests of others. So there are things that we can hope to do that we can measure progress on.
Yeah, we'll be watching. With Eddie and Lesser, I'm afraid we've got to say goodbye. But Ian Lesser, thank you very much for joining us tonight from Los Angeles. Dan Byman in Washington, thanks so much for being with us. This is On Point. We're going to end this hour with the message that King Juan Carlos of Spain delivered to his nation earlier today in the wake of the deadly terrorist attack in Madrid. While constitutionally powerless, the king remains a beloved figure in Spain. He spent much of the day visiting survivors of the Madrid bombings in hospitals. This was his message to the people of Spain today, as translated by WBUR's Rizul Gunasti.
La barbarie terrorista ha sumido hoy a España en el más profundo dolor.
The barbarity of terrorism has brought Spain the greatest level of pain and suffering. This repulsive act has affected women, men, and children. Free citizens of all ages and occupations, including free citizens from other countries. When these free citizens were going to their destinations, schools, and jobs, they were brutally confronted by death and suffering. This nightmarish scene has affected all the homes of Spain, displaying the cruelest face of terrorism. In these tragic moments, me and my family would like to give our deepest condolences to the families of the victims. We will always be on your side, always on the side of those who suffer from this incomprehensible and macabre act. This repugnant act deserves only the strongest condemnation. The king suffers along with his citizens and shares in the indignation. I trust in the efficiency and the strength of state authorities. These cowardly and vile assassins will be captured and prosecuted by the authorities. The terrorist will realize their crime and be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. The citizens of Madrid, always generous, have grown as a result of this tragedy and display their solidarity and strength. The security corps will never give up in the defense of our rights. The good heart of Spain will once more help with the material and moral needs of the victims. Spain is a great country, a country that displays its ability to surpass all difficulties. Unity, firmness, and serenity will guide Spain in these difficult moments. Unity, firmness, and serenity, combined with the police, government, and international cooperation, will put an end to terrorism. Unity, firmness, and serenity, respect for difference of opinion, our constitution, and peaceful coexistence will guarantee the sovereign expression of our rights. In these times of great pain, the Spanish people are called on more than ever to show our determination to end terrorism. No one should doubt that terrorism will never achieve its objectives nor stop the democratic process. No one can shake our confidence in the future of Spain.
King Juan Carlos of Spain speaking in a televised address to his countrymen and women earlier today. His speech was read and translated by WBUR's Rizul Gunasti. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.